This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Julian Warwicker. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 29th of October. On the eve of the budget, another announcement from the government about its contents, a confirmed rise in the minimum wage. We'll do the sums and hear how the world of business is likely to react. A week before the presidential election in the United States, the former executive editor of The Washington Post tells us why he's so critical of the paper endorsing neither candidate. And the producer who helped bring together the Buena Vista Social Club band pays tribute to its trumpet player, Manuel Guajiro Mirabal, who has died at the age of 91. Budget Day is nearly upon us. It feels as if the build-up to this one, the first to be delivered by a Labour Chancellor in 14 years, has been particularly long drawn out. Some of that has been due to the timing of the summer general election. But as the date for it has drawn near, there's been barely a day without a hint of some of its contents or a debate about who's going to pay more in tax. Well, today there was more than a hint about one measure, confirmation, in fact, that the minimum wage will rise to £12.21 an hour next year. That's a 6.7% increase. Darren Jones is the Chief Secretary to the Treasury.
This is a down payment on commitment to make living standards improve for working people across the country, and I know it will be a good news for workers in receipt of that increase in their wages in due course.
Well, business owners, particularly small ones, have voiced concerns over the impact of higher wage bills alongside the workers' rights reforms, which the government has already announced. This was Darren Jones' response.
I think we're all clear that a pro-worker, pro-business approach to the economy is the right approach, and investing in your workforce is a great way to improve your productivity, not least because you'll have more people across the country with more money in their pocket being able to spend it in the economy.
In a moment, we'll hear from Labour, but first, the BBC's employment correspondent, Zoe Conway, is with me. So some details on this announcement, Zoe, first of all. How big a rise is this?
The government says that these new minimum pay rates will affect 3 million people. For those over the age of 21, they'll be entitled from April to a minimum of £12.21 an hour, so that's a 6.7% increase. For those aged 18 to 20, much higher percentage increase of 16%, taking the minimum up to £10 an hour. And for 16 and 17-year-olds and apprentices, their rate goes up by 18% to £7.55 an hour. Now, what's been asked today is why is this increase so much higher than inflation, which is currently running at 1.7%? And part of the reason is that the Low Pay Commission, which makes these recommendations, is required by the government to make sure that the minimum pay keeps up with average earnings, that it doesn't fall below two-thirds of average earnings. And earnings have been growing across the economy. And so that's one of the reasons why we're seeing such a big increase. And I think one of the really interesting questions today is how does this all fit with the government's number one priority to grow the economy? Because the government argues that this will help growth, because if you pay people better, then you can encourage more people to get back into the workforce, and they want to get economic inactivity down. That's very important for growth. They also think it will help make people more productive. But what businesses are warning today is that it could have a negative impact on growth.
Just give us a sense of that reaction, what you've heard so far.
Well, there's a little bit of a difference in terms of whether we're talking about small or big business. For small business, they're not seeing this in isolation. They're seeing this along with other changes the government is making. So not just the minimum wage, but we're looking at an increase in national insurance payments by employers. Also, a change in workers' rights, a strengthening of workers' rights from day one of employment. The details are yet to be hammered out. But what small businesses are concerned about, that as a package, that will put too much cost on them and that they will be reluctant to hire. So how does that fit in with the growth agenda? For big business, there's a question mark here about what impact this will have on firms' ability to invest in innovation. Again, how does that affect growth? How does that affect productivity? And just finally, the TUC, that represents the trade union movement, they say, well, business have, you know, issued the alarm about the minimum wage for the last 25 years, but it's always been unfounded, those calls of alarm.
Zoe, thank you very much. Zoe Conway, we'll get some Labour reaction in a moment. But first, Siobhan Haviland is the Director General of the British Chambers of Commerce and a former head of business engagement at number 10 Downing Street. Siobhan Haviland, good evening.
Good evening.
What reaction are you sensing on this just now?
Yes, interesting. So, you know, our members believe that people are at the heart of their businesses. They really want to support and pay their staff well. Of course they do. But this is another on cost for business. National wage went up about 10% last April, and that's obviously another 6.5%. And remember, it's not just the people on the that level of wages. Those above them on the wage scale will want to see their wages, you know, increased in line with those differentials. So it will be a big cost to business.
Can business afford this?
Well, in the end, there's only so much, you know, money in the bank, as it were. So if you're increasing wages, or tomorrow we see increasing taxes for businesses, they can't pass all those on as prices to customers, of course. So they'll have to look in other places. And our concern is that that will mean they will stop using their cash to invest in expansion and growth and new products, etc.
You heard reference from Zoe Conway to the Low Pay Commission, and the head of that organisation, Baroness Philippa Stroud, has been clear that when arriving at this recommendation, they did take into consideration a balance of factors, including the rising costs for businesses here. Do you accept that analysis?
We think the Low Pay Commission is the right body to set these wage levels. They are independent. We feed in, you know, advice to them, and there's a fine balance to be struck. I think we'll see a bit more. We'll understand a bit more tomorrow when we see from the budget whether there are more tax rises. And, you know, as your correspondent said earlier, they do impact smaller businesses who have less. A bit less ability to absorb these price rises into their balance sheet.
When you look at the overall package here, I mean, Zoe Conway outlined the percentage elements. This, by recent standards, is a smaller increase in the minimum wage because it's the first time in almost a decade when it's risen no faster than typical wage growth. So the government is, in theory and in practice, taking account of some of the concerns that you've outlined, surely?
That's right. And as I said, you know, we saw a 10% increase in April. We're seeing 6.7% coming up next April. That is, it's a cumulative thing. And then on top of tax rises in the budget tomorrow, it's just, you know, it's just less space for business to make changes. And they'll, in the end, they'll raise prices or they will reduce staff numbers. So we're really hoping that the Chancellor tomorrow, you know, will focus as well as on tax rises, what she's going to do to help drive growth.
Thank you very much for your thoughts. Listening to that is Jeevan Sander, the Labour MP for Loughborough and a former economic advisor at the Treasury and Department of Work and Pensions. Good evening to you.
Good evening. It's wonderful to be here.
Good to have your thoughts as well. Particularly interested to hear your thoughts off the back of what we just heard from Siobhan Haviland. How do you react to some of the reservations that she has about this?
Well, look, this measure is good for businesses and it's good for workers. Your listeners will know why it's good for workers. An increase up to £1,400, young workers getting over 16% more. We're literally making work pay. But for businesses, when workers are paid a little bit more, they're more productive at work because they're less stressed about paying the bills. Last year, we lost about 5 billion in sickness-related absences. Moreover, they have more commitment to the firm they're in. They invest more in that relationship. And more broadly for this budget, which we'll be setting out, investing to get growth, that gets sales up for businesses as well. This is a budget being great for businesses, and this is a measure being great for businesses and great for workers.
That may be true for some, but as you heard from Siobhan Haviland, there will be others with reservations because of what else they might have to find, what else they might have to change, especially if as Rachel Reeves has hinted, this may come again in the relatively near future.
Well, more broadly, right, I can't comment on specific measures, obviously, about tomorrow. We're going to see. Look, I'm personally incredibly excited for the first Labour budget in 15 years, the first time we get to turn this country around. But we look at all the measures we're taking, the stuff that was in our manifesto, investing in clean energy to get bills down for good, investing in skills so small businesses get the skills that they need and the workers they need in the future. It's going to be an incredibly exciting business. Look, in rather budget, rather, had we grown at new Labour rates for the past 14 years, average wage would be £10,000 higher today. That's the problem we face. That's what we start to fix.
Let's talk about what you've said about growth, because we are anticipating increases in national insurance contributions for employers, something that certainly wasn't spelt out in the manifesto you referred to a moment ago. Possibly an increase in capital gains tax. Now we know there'll be a record rise in the minimum wage. How is that a recipe for growth?
Well, I can't comment on specific measures.
I accept that, but that's the broad brush that the government itself has been gently hinting at for the last several days.
I wish we could. Public sector investment does also need to be paid for, and paid for through tax revenue. Now, when waiting lists are at record highs, when 3 million people are out of work because they're too sick to work, it's care our health service needs investment. When schools are literally crumbling, when half of schools don't have the maths teachers they need, it's clear they need investment. We have the worst insulated homes in Western Europe. It's clear we need investment. That's the kind of investment we need to pay for. And also part of that, of course, is paid for through tax rises. Mm. Now, what those tax rises will be in future in the round, we will see in the budget tomorrow.
That may be true, but did you spell that out as clearly as you just have to me prior to the election?
We absolutely set out the fact we were going to invest in public services. We set out the fact we were going to end the non-dom tax break. We set out the fact we were going to end the private school tax break.
But there may well
be
more,
clearly. We extend windfall tax. And there may be measures tomorrow in the budget. But again, I can't really comment on that because I don't know, honestly, Julian. We will see tomorrow. But to be clear, we have to invest in this country as well to get this country moving and to get it growing.
Talk to me about the fact that the previous government also significantly raised the minimum wage just over 6 months ago. So that's two major rises within a year. As I say, Rachel Reeves hinting that we're going further at some point down that road. Businesses may start to look at that and cut back on hiring. We just heard that concern from Siobhan Haviland. Are you worried about that?
I think, as you referenced, the Low Pay Commission does set this, or helps to set this, in reference to where average earnings are. So it's not about how much they're rising in, if you like, numbers terms, how much they're raising or rising as a proportion of the average wage. About two-thirds at this point in time. The last government had a huge review by some American economist, Duvet in particular, a very long one, but it's very good. I do recommend the read. And actually, it's had a very few, like zero employment effects at this rate. So it is set in relation to that. It is set in relation to where the economy is and where average wages are. It's a good way to boost wages for workers.
One final one about the choreography of all this. The Speaker is not happy. Why have you been leaking so much of this in advance?
Because what else do we talk about, Julian?
That's not a serious answer, as you well know.
But it is, Julian, because in an ideal world, do you know how this game is played, right? In an ideal world, we would all wait for the budget, and I would love it if we then spent a week or weeks or even months analysing the aspects of it. But what really happens is, for the weeks up to leading to it, there is this constant speculation game.
There's speculation, but you don't have to feed it. And this is a discourtesy to the House, says Lindsay Hoyle.
Well, I obviously, as you mentioned, I'm a newly elected MP. I'm certainly not part of the team. Obviously, I've seen measures being reported. I don't know if they're right. I don't know what the details are. But more broadly, yes, there is this kind of constant game. As you pointed out, I've used to work in the Treasury. I've seen this happen for 10 or 15 years now. I suspect it's going to happen again.
Thank you very much for coming on the programme, Jeevan Sander, Labour MP for Loughborough. Coming up later, the woman who ran Oregon's hospice care program in the United States explains why she supports assisted dying and why she thinks it goes hand in hand with good palliative care.
I think they go well together. I think that it's a good push to get hospice and palliative care available all through the country.
More on that coming a little later. First, though, with just a week to go until Americans vote in the presidential election, it's an evening of big rallies for both candidates. Kamala Harris is in Washington, where she's delivering what's being described as her closing argument to the electorate. Donald Trump is back in the key swing state of Pennsylvania, but he began his day in Florida, where, at a press conference at Mar-a-Lago, he defended his controversial rally in Madison Square Garden over the weekend, where a comedian made what are being called racist jokes about Puerto Rico. Donald Trump said the event was a big success.
I don't think anybody has ever seen anything like what happened the other night at Madison Square Garden. The love in that room, it was breathtaking, and you could have filled it many, many times with the people that were unable to get in. But politicians that have been doing this for a long time, 30 and 40 years, said there's never been an event so beautiful. It was like a love fest, an absolute love fest, and it was my honor to be involved.
Well, it's against that backdrop of 11th-hour campaigning and opinion polls which are close to neck and neck that one of America's most esteemed publications, The Washington Post, has decided to endorse neither candidate for the election. The same decision has been made at the Los Angeles Times. In the case of The Post, the paper has endorsed a presidential candidate in every election since 1976, bar one. And the decision has prompted resignations, a letter of protest from a group of its opinion writers, and 200,000 subscribers to go elsewhere. The paper's owner, Jeff Bezos, has denied that the decision was motivated by his financial interests. He's echoed the words of the paper's chief executive and publisher, William Lewis, who said it was for the readers to make up their own minds. Well, earlier I spoke to the paper's former executive editor, Marty Baron, and asked him why he thought the decision had been made.
The Post had been publishing presidential endorsements regularly since 1976, with only 1 year of exception, 1988. Under Jeff Bezos' ownership, they published presidential endorsement in 2016 and also in 2020. So something has changed. I think that what has changed, I mean, what we can observe, is that Donald Trump has become more virulent in his attacks on his perceived political enemies. He has stated quite openly and consistently that he intends to exact vengeance on his political enemies. And Jeff Bezos has always been perceived as a political enemy solely because of the coverage of the Washington Post. Bezos has other business interests, which, of course, he acknowledges and calls a complexifier for him. Obviously, huge stake in Amazon, which he founded, and then also a private space company called Blue Origin, which has contracts with the federal government. Amazon also has many contracts with the federal government.
So you don't know why this has happened, but you strongly suspect it's because Jeff Bezos thinks Donald Trump will punish him if he wins.
Well, my suspicion is that that's entering his mind, because I can't find anything else that explains a sudden change of position on whether to publish editorials.
What of the argument made by the newspaper's chief executive and publisher, William Lewis, who said in a statement, "We are returning to our roots of not endorsing presidential candidates"?
The newspaper started making presidential endorsements regularly in 1976. What occurred about that time? What prompted that change? Well, it was Watergate. It was Richard Nixon. It was a president who abused his power and weaponized the federal government against his political enemies. What is the issue that we face today? We have a candidate who is threatening to weaponize the federal government against his political enemies. The publisher said in his own statement that the rationale in 1976 was understandable. Well, if it was understandable then it surely should be understandable today.
Jeff Bezos says they don't make any difference. Quote, presidential endorsements do nothing to tip the scales of an election. No undecided voters in Pennsylvania are going to say, I'm going with newspaper A's endorsement.
I think he's probably right about that. And if he had made that case 6 months ago or a year ago, 2 years ago, that would have been fine. One could make the same case about all editorials, frankly. Do they really make a difference in terms of how people think? They're a statement of values of the newspaper. One can reasonably argue that, well, they shouldn't run any editorials or they shouldn't run any political endorsements whatsoever. That's fine. We'll do that six outside of the election cycle, not as you're getting close to the moment when it looks entirely possible that Donald Trump will again be president of the United States.
A group of 21 opinion writers have published a letter protesting at the decision. Some individuals have gone further. They've resigned. What do you say to those who've decided to walk away?
I would like people to stay at the Post and continue to do the good work that they are known for. And very important to me, they continue to do extraordinary investigative work, including about Donald Trump, about Kamala Harris, about other political figures, other institutions with power and individuals with power. And I think that needs the support of subscribers. Hope they would continue to subscribe. But it also needs the support of people who are working there.
I was struck by something you said a moment ago. If Donald Trump turns out to be president in a week's time, and you said it in a way that suggested to me you think that's the most likely outcome. Is that what you're thinking at the moment?
Well, no, that's not what I'm thinking. I have no idea how this election is going to turn out. I have no idea. There are too many unknowns in this election. There are a lot of them. And I have no idea which way that will fall.
Marty Baron, former editor of the Washington Post. And a reminder that in an article for the newspaper, the owner Jeff Bezos said that his business interests were not a factor in the decision not to endorse a candidate. Now, in exactly a month's time, MPs here will debate the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill. It's being put forward by the Labour MP, Kim Leadbeater. And if passed, it would give terminally ill people in England and Wales the right to end their lives. It'll be a free vote, so MPs will make their decisions based on their consciences rather than having to follow a party line. The Prime Minister has said that he believes there are grounds for changing the law. But the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, is on the other side of the argument, as he told BBC Breakfast this morning.
I've made it clear that I'll be voting against the assisted dying bill this time. That's mainly because I don't think that palliative care, end-of-life care, is where it needs to be to give people a real choice. I'm concerned about the risk of people being coerced into taking their lives sooner than they would have liked, or feeling, even without pressure from their families, sometimes guilt-tripped, feeling like a burden. Okay. And I've had to weigh up all of those issues.
Well, as MPs consider the issue, some are looking abroad to places where assisted dying legislation is already in place. One of those is the US state of Oregon, which was the first in America to legalize physician-assisted dying. That was in 1997. The law there has stayed largely unchanged since. People must have a terminal illness with less than 6 months to live and be mentally competent before they can apply to end their lives. Two doctors must agree to the prescription of lethal medicines, and the patient is required to self-administer them. The doctors involved must also tell the patient about alternatives, such as palliative care. Well, Ann Jackson is the former head of the Oregon Hospice Association. She initially opposed the assisted dying legislation, but has since changed her mind. She's advised different governments around the world on the issue and has advised British MPs in the recent past on how the law works in Oregon.
I strongly believed that medical aid in dying was unnecessary if Oregonians had access to high-quality hospice and palliative care. But by the time the act was implemented, all Oregonians did have access. And after its implementation, I soon recognized how arrogantly dismissive I had been. There are many valid needs that people have that cannot be provided by hospice alone. The autonomy issues are very important to those people who use the law. My fiancé did use the law 5 years ago, and I was with him at that time. That was the first time I had been present when somebody had actually used the law.
He was diagnosed with cancer at that time, I think, wasn't he?
He had been diagnosed with cancer just after we started dating. We had met on eHarmony.com. And it was very severe, and he did not think he was going to survive very long. However, he responded to treatment extraordinarily well. And so we had a very good 10 years together.
But the fact that he was, in the end, able to make a decision about the end of his life, how important was that both to him and to you?
The first day we met, he told me he intended to use the law. As soon as anybody knows what it is that I do for my work, they almost invariably, they say, well, I intend to use that. And I'm someone that people can talk about it with.
The Secretary of State for Health in England, Wes Streeting, is not going to vote in favour of the assisted dying bill being debated here. And one of the reasons he gives is that the palliative care system is not, as he puts it, where it needs to be to give people choice. C- Can you see why he might have that reservation if those circumstances are as he says they are?
When Oregon's law was first submitted, I was the director of the Oregon Hospice Association. And so for the next several years, I made sure that every Oregonian in the state had access to hospice care. And hospice is palliative care, of course. And I know the delivery of both of these services is different in the United States than it is in the UK. But I think they go well together. I think that it's a good push to get hospice and palliative care available all through the country.
Does palliative care need to reach a certain standard in your mind before it's safe to introduce an assisted dying legislation?
No, I don't. I don't think it is. I don't think that palliative care is a requirement. It just isn't. It isn't necessary that people should have to have both at the same time. I think it's desirable. I would like to think that it would be an impetus for the UK to establish hospice. And maybe they would be doing that more reliably.
The other concern aired by Wes Streeting, the Secretary of State for Health here, he said that he was concerned about people being coerced into taking their own lives sooner than they would have liked, or feeling guilt-tripped, or feeling like a burden. How do you respond to that concern?
Hospice workers are in the homes of these people every day. They do not see that occurring. They're excellent watchers of what really happens in those homes. And people are not being made to use the law. That's one of the fallacies that people always state, but the data does not support it. The hospice workers have been nurses, doctors. There are published articles. There's hardly anything that I cannot refute that somebody complains about.
Anne Jackson, and please keep sending your comments and experiences on this issue. We'll aim to share as many as we can on air to help inform the debate. You can email world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. Use WhatsApp. The number is 03700 100 444. Or you can send us a text on 84844, but bear in mind your phone service provider may charge for that. Another of our main headlines tonight, the teenager accused of murdering three young girls in a knife attack in Southport has now been charged with a terror offence. Merseyside police say the charges against 18-year-old Axel Rudakubana relate to producing the poison ricin and possessing a military study of an Al-Qaeda training manual. Counter-terrorism police have not declared the matter a terrorist incident, which would require evidence of a motive to be present.
The two further offences relate to evidence obtained by Merseyside police during searches of Axel Rudakubana's home address as part of a lengthy and complex investigation which has been ongoing since the 29th of July. The additional charges are the production of a biological toxin, namely ricin, contrary to Section 1 of the Biological Weapons Act 1974, and possession of information, namely a PDF file entitled Military Studies in the Jihad Against the Tyrants, the Al-Qaeda Training Manual, likely to be useful to a person committing or preparing to commit an act of terrorism.
That was Chief Constable of Merseyside Police Serena Kennedy on the two new charges against Axel Rudakubana, who will appear at Westminster Magistrates Court on Wednesday. Chan Chan, the opening track of the hugely successful Buena Vista Social Club album and documentary about the Cuban music collective. And we're hearing it because the man playing that trumpet solo, Manuel Guajiro Mirabal, has died at the age of 91. Well, Nick Gold is a record producer who helped bring the Buena Vista Social Club band together in 1996. So what was so special about Mirabal's trumpet playing?
He's got a sound and phrasing that immediately take you to a time and a place. Well, for me, I'm in that studio in Old Havana, and huge amounts of history of Cuban music just pour through as soon as you hear him. And we heard him in a session with a bigger band, which was much more prescriptive music. And then when we got onto Buena Vista, which was a very small group, very loosely arranged, he really came to the fore. He's the only horn on that record, and he just brought an incredible personality and character and sensitivity to the record. And his playing is as personal as any of the singers' statements on the record, I think. It's very powerful melodically and emotionally.
And improvised to a large extent, or some of it, but I mean, then when performing it, presumably the audiences wanted to hear what he'd done last time. So he couldn't change it too much.
Well, no, he couldn't. The way that that record was made, it was all made live in a studio, so everyone playing at once, and nearly everything was a first take. So there would be little rehearsals and sound checks and so forth, of which he didn't really participate. He just sat there on his chair, cradling his trumpet, watching. And he was obviously working out what he was going to do and getting a feel for it. So the first time any of the group heard what he was going to play was when we actually put down a take. And then those takes became little miniature masterpieces, these little improvisations he did. They became so beloved that you're right. Anytime he had to play them in a concert, people wanted to hear exactly those solos that he improvised on that day. He loved being on tour. So he was very, very musical. Like, he was either playing trumpet all the time, or he was whistling or humming tunes all the time. And he loved being with the ensemble. He was very much a part of an ensemble. He wasn't a star, but also loved traveling and loved touring and sharing this heritage and this music with these, you know, adoring fans that he found all over the world.
Do you have a favourite recording of his?
There's four that are on Buena Vista, all of which I think have got iconic solos. Chan Chan itself, the opening track. There's Dos Gardenias, which is a beautifully sensitive solo. Cuatro de Tula, which is a very powerful piece. Amongst those three, maybe the solos in Dos Gardenias, the bolero, are the most heartfelt, I think.
And if there's one memory, what's coming to mind for you today?
Just seeing him there in the studio, just holding his own court, cradling this trumpet and thinking and whistling away and tapping, waiting, and then just playing like an angel.
Great music and great memories for Nick Gold, reflecting on the life of Manuel Guajiro Mirabal. Well, we're going to end the programme where we began by looking ahead to tomorrow's budget. With me are two seasoned observers of the political scene, Katie Balls, political editor of The Spectator, and Alva Ray, associate editor at Bloomberg UK. Good evening to you both.
Evening.
Let's start with the significance of tomorrow's moment, the political moment for Labour, for Rachel Reeves. Katie Balls, how do you see it?
Well, I think it's the government's first big test since the election. Now, clearly there have been lots of things that have happened in the first 100 days, but this is an event of the government's own making. Rachel Reeves made the decision to have it later on because she wanted to consult the OBR first. But if you look at the challenges facing the Labour government in terms of the pledges they made during the election on not raising the main taxes, if you look at the costs at the moment and look at what Rachel Reeves wants to do in investment, I think squaring the circle and trying to keep the markets, MPs and also voters on side is quite hard to do.
Alva Ray, do you sense some nervous Labour MPs on the eve of tomorrow?
I do, yeah. I mean, it depends on who you speak to, because there are so many of them now, but I think quite a few of them just feel like this needs to be a reset moment, which the budget was never really intended to be. It was intended to be the difficult budget where they did the things that they had to do early on in the parliament. But given all of the things that have happened in the past few months that Casey mentioned, I think that there's also just renewed pressure on this moment because of the kind of the shaky start, like months of sort of rise over freebies, the sort of the change of personnel in number 10. So I think that MPs are nervous about it at this point.
But can a budget, particularly one where taxes are going to rise, be a reset?
Well, I think this is the thing. And I actually think when you zoom out of all of the sort of the slightly tedious sometimes debate that we've been having about how you define a working person, that's like the, I think when you zoom out of that, this is the biggest question. That tomorrow Rachel Reeves is almost certainly going to announce one of the UK's biggest ever tax raising events, and I think that there's a quite legitimate question to be asked about whether Labour actually has a mandate for that. You know, we just had an election where Labour did not say that they would implement huge tax increases. And Labour MPs know that. And I think that there is just some nerves about, you know, what will the front pages of some of the right-wing papers in particular look like on Thursday morning, and also just how will voters feel, even if the individual pay rises don't necessarily hit pay packets, as Labour people would be keen to point out.
Katie Balls, what's your reading of the way we built up to tomorrow? And by that, I mean the fact that we learn day by day some of the elements of this budget, some deliberately, some perhaps less so. What's been going on there, do you think?
So I think that this is part of a trend. I mean, you've had the Speaker this week tell off the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, for the fact so much has disappeared in the press.
Disrespectfully, he said.
Exactly. But this is also the same charge which was levelled at the Tories many times when they were in government. And I think that, one, you do get leaks. But secondly, since the Liz Truss mini-budget particularly, but I think it was a trend slightly before, there is a view in the Treasury and in government that there is very little to be won from surprising on budget day. Having a tax cut or even a tax rise that the markets and business are not expecting is seen as something that is jittery and tricky to do, which I think is one of the reasons that so much has been floated in advance. And the fiscal rule change on infrastructure and borrowing, that is something where I think the Treasury purposely wanted to make sure that was out there in advance so the markets could get their heads around it. Now, I still think there's a question as to why Keir Starmer has confirmed certain measures, such as the bus cap, not others, and it makes it quite confusing. I think some of that is a comms problem, but some of this, I think, is purposeful.
Does that Alva Ray rule out any surprises tomorrow, do you think?
I think it probably does rule out any big surprises. I'm going to be such a hostage to fortune saying that, but I think that definitely nothing that could spook markets should happen tomorrow. And we've seen so many of the tax increases quite heavily trailed, and of course this change to the fiscal rules, which will give Rachel Reeves much more room for borrowing for investment. But I still think that with budgets, it takes it more than a few hours to kind of really digest what's in it, because as well as all of these massive historic tax increases that we'll see, we will see some cuts to departments, sort of not necessarily for the overall budget, but enough that before, you know, in the past few weeks, some cabinet ministers have been really quite concerned privately about them. I think it'll take us a couple of days to dig into those, okay, and that could be where the controversy lies.
Very briefly, Katie, if you would, but what will success look like tomorrow from Rachel Reeves' point of view?
But I think success, to Alva's point, comes in a week, because budgets can unravel and it can be slow. But success for Rachel Reeves is a situation where the Labour Party is not an open revolt, where the markets stay calm and where voters don't turn on the government.
Thank you both so much for those thoughts. We may come back to you and test out how accurate you've been, Katie Balls and Alva Ray. Just time for our reminding closing headline. On the eve of the budget, the government's announced hikes in the minimum wage, saying more than 3 million workers will benefit. That is The World Tonight. I'm Julian Warwick. Back at 10 tomorrow. But from me and everyone on the programme, have a very good night.